Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and as always, I'm joined by my co-presenter John Dorney of TheIrishStory.com. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, you can check out our website, IrishHistoryShow.ie. You can check us out on Twitter, Irish History Pod. Go to our Facebook page, Irish History Show. So today we were going to talk about the treaty. Now that could be 10 episodes, could be 10 hours long. But where do we start? If we're going to put it in some type of context, John, the treaty and the negotiations, how do we get to this point?
Okay, so the Anglo-Irish Treaty, which was signed in December 6, 1921, is supposed to be the final settlement for the Irish question, which in that form goes back to the 1880s and the first campaign for Home Rule. The Home Rule first proposed in the 1880s was limited self-government for Ireland. It was not leaving the United Kingdom. If we go to the last Home Rule Bill, the third Home Rule Bill, which is put before the British Parliament in 1912, gets passed but suspended in 1914. This proposed Dublin Parliament, but after the Ulster mobilisation against it, would have excluded the six counties. So that was already a hot issue as early as 1912. The Home Rule Bill was enacted in a way in 1920, the Government of Ireland Act, which instituted a Northern Parliament and a Southern Parliament. By that point, though, public opinion in the South had certainly, or the 26 counties, had certainly moved on and been radicalised by events like the First World War, the reaction against conscription, Easter Rising, of course, the reaction against the executions of the leaders and the repression after the Rising, and above all, probably by the continued stalling of Home Rule. So Home Rule was supposed to be passed in 1914, wasn't passed. A part of the country was partitioned already de facto, really, in 1914. Not yet partitioned, but that was already sort of passed into law by the exclusion of six northeastern counties. With the rise of Sinn Féin, which, you know, we could talk about for a whole other 2 hours, but with the rise of Sinn Féin, basically the pro-independence party, public opinion in the South had moved beyond Home Rule, which was like autonomy within the United Kingdom, and the Irish Republic was declared in January of 1919 for the full independence of the whole of Ireland. And this was the position to which Republicans staked their colours. There was political mobilisation, there was an alternative state created, there was the Dáil Courts created. So the idea was to treat the Irish Republic like it was a real existing state, and in some ways it was. And accompanying this, of course, is what we know as now as the Irish War of Independence, which was a guerrilla campaign by the volunteers, the Irish Republican Army, against the British state, which was a conflict that started out as a very low-intensity conflict in 1919. There was probably, I think, 20 or 30 victims. It spiralled out of control in late 1920 to 1921. And by mid-1921, the British were very conscious that the solution that they'd been trying to propose, the Home Rule solution, was no longer going to be viable. They'd need a new solution to end this violence, which was draining resources, which was a big political problem, which was making them look very bad in the world. There was a truce arranged in July 1921, which was de facto recognition of the Republican leadership, not of the Republic, but of the Republicans as representatives of the Irish people, of Sinn Féin as representatives of the Irish people. And negotiations were started in November 1921 to produce a final settlement.
As you say there before with the 1920 Government of Ireland Act, the British government had passed Home Rule all round, two equal Home Rule parliaments, one for Dublin, 26 counties, one for Belfast, six North East counties. And this idea of Council of Ireland, which could possibly become a vehicle to reunification, but still quite a limited form of autonomy and self-government within the United Kingdom, and far less than, you know, the expectations were becoming. But like I said there about like the exclusion of the North East, in some of the negotiations, some of the discussions you get before the Third Home Rule Bill, that's what they are discussing, exclusion, not a Home Rule Parliament for Belfast, just continued direct rule for whatever part of Ulster, whether it would be nine counties, six counties, four counties, where the local inhabitants didn't want to come under a Dublin Parliament. What you're saying there as well about, like, you know, how the British government views the Dáil, views the cabinet in Dublin, and what they're going to refer to themselves as, or how they're going to see them in terms of the negotiations, is quite interesting.
Well, just to back up a little bit, one thing I think we have to get clear before we talk about the treaty is Home Rule means autonomy in the United Kingdom, and it wouldn't have given a lot of the powers of statehood. Most of the powers, vital powers of statehood, would not have been granted under Home Rule.
Hmm.
And what I'm talking about here is the Home Rule Bill didn't allow for an Irish army, didn't allow for an Irish police force. They would have retained the RIC. The command of the RIC would have been retained by British government via, I believe, a governor in Ireland, would not have been under the control of the Home Rule Parliament. Things like the postal service, and the biggest thing of all that makes the state, which is the taxation system, the Home Rule Parliament couldn't have collected its own taxes. It was to get a budget, rather, from London every year. The budget may actually have been slightly larger than the take from the Irish state could have generated.
Yeah.
However, that's not the point, though. I mean, from the point of view of independence, the Home Rule Bill was not next or near to independence. Now, there was actually some provision down the line, this is the British way of thinking, if the Home Rule government had been provided responsible government, there was provision down the line for extension of things like control over policing and possibly taxation down the line. But those things were not available under Home Rule in 1914. So there can be no confusion that, to get ahead of ourselves slightly, that there can be no confusion that Home Rule and the treaty were the same thing. They certainly were not the same thing. Home Rule was limited autonomy, and the treaty, as we'll discuss, is almost independence for the southern state.
Well, the idea with the discussions about the treaty was that Ireland was going to be a dominion, something similar to Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, Canada. And I think the arguments from Republicans' point of view was that they weren't on Britain's doorstep, that they had virtual independence due to the fact that they were so far away from Britain.
Let's look at both sides of this. Like, dominion status means independence, but just membership of the Commonwealth.
Mm.
Like, that's actually a big concession on the British part. So much of the, not so much the nuts and bolts of the separatist or the Republican movement, but the, let's say, the emotive feeling behind it is about rejection of British rule, saying Ireland is not British, and we reject all the symbols and all the vestiges of British rule. So there's an emotional kind of component to it. There's a difference in the history of, for example, Ireland and Canada. Canada is a place settled by British settlers, which is a long way, as you say, is a long way from Britain, and gets self-government on behalf of Britain, and they're happy to see themselves that way. And from Irish nationalists, the narrative is entirely different. Like, this is a country which has been, from a nationalist point of view, has been conquered and colonised, had been treated as an inferior, and wants to proclaim its nationhood and its equality with Britain. And as you say, yes, you're quite right. People who were against the idea of dominion status argued that it's very difficult for Britain to intervene in the politics of Canada, just logistically, had they wanted to. It's very easy for Britain to interfere in the politics of Ireland, which is right next door.
From the Republicans' point of view, you had 1916, the Republic declared, the 1918 election where Sinn Féin wins 73 seats out of 108. There's a mandate there for a republic. A republic is declared in 1919. From the Sinn Féin perspective, from the Republicans' perspective, the republic already exists. Tortue County already exists.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. That is, of course, the Republican position, and that's what the average Republican on the ground in 1921 believes. One of the interesting things, though, is when you look at the leadership, people like Michael Collins, of course, came round to accepting dominion status. There's signs to him that he and Arthur Griffith would have accepted dominion status in December 1920 when it was offered. Actually, the British had to withdraw the offer because the divisions on their own side. But De Valera, it seems, was willing to accept. He was willing to accept something less than the Republic. The Republic was a negotiating position. De Valera seems to have been willing to accept dominion status for all of Ireland, or a Republic, or an Irish state not affiliated with the British Crown that was partitioned. One or the other was his plan. The All-Ireland Republic was like a... Frank O'Connor described it in his memoirs as like a giant bluff, that they were acting like they could face down the British Empire, when, in fact, you know, militarily speaking, they couldn't. Just moving the discussion on a little bit, I mean, from the British point of view, what they've got here is a situation where they can't control what's happening really in Ireland anymore, except for by a campaign of repression, which they're preparing to do. I mean, the correspondence going back and forth, MacCready is the commander-in-chief, are talking about, you know, mass arrests, thousands and thousands of arrests, declaring the whole country a military area, hundreds of executions each month. They're talking about really, really hardcore repression. But they don't really want to go down that road. On the other hand, they have some vital interests they have to safeguard in Ireland. They want to retain the ports of Ireland, and this is explicitly explained to Collins and others in the treaty negotiations. At one point, apparently, Collins was shown a map of the Atlantic campaign in the First World War, where British supplies had come from to and from America. And Collins pointed out that if they had Le Havre in France, that it would be the best possible port. And he was told that's quite true, but we can't annex Le Havre. You know, but that was really central in the British thinking, yeah, from a strategic point of view. But almost as important from the British point of view is that they're not seen to lose Ireland. They have to be clear that they come out of it. They've negotiated an acceptable settlement. They've retained Ireland as a loyal dominion. And that has to be the way it's portrayed. You know, otherwise they lose credibility in front of the world. And I mean, they have a lot of other colonies to think about.
Well, I think if we discuss as well the makeup of the British government at that time, you had Lloyd George as Prime Minister and leader of the Liberals, although, you know, the Liberal Party is split between an Asquith wing, the former Prime Minister. But he is not the leader of the largest party in the government, is he?
It's the remnants of a wartime unity government.
Yeah, like the major part of the government at the time is the Conservatives, what would have been called the Unionist Party. The Unionists being the Conservative and the National Liberals, the old Liberal wing that split away from Gladstone in 1886. So he is sort of a prisoner to the Unionists in his own government. And it's surprising, really, that he continued on as Prime Minister in that situation, or that the Conservatives didn't look for the main job for themselves.
I mean, I don't have really any insights into Lloyd George's character, but I mean, the only thing I'll say is that, like, I think Britain's kind of strategic interests would have been the same regardless of who's actually in power in Westminster. Now, there is a difference, though, as you say, because the Conservatives had a very close and almost familial relationship with the Ulster Unionists. And that did make a difference, of course, when we talk about the issue of partition. But I think as regards the issue of recognising an Irish Republic and retaining a certain strategic interest, they would have been the same regardless, I think.
I think even if we go back to 1917, before the 1918 election, when Sinn Féin is reformed, like, I always think it's interesting when people say that Sinn Féin today is still the exact same party to 1905, and it's been like, you know, one continuous thing. We can really say that Sinn Féin of that period is formed in 1917 with the Volunteers, Plunkett's Liberty Clubs, and Griffith's old Sinn Féin party. But like, they're policy at that time regarding the Republic is that they're in favour of an independent sovereign Irish Republic, and then the Irish people themselves can decide whether they want to be a dominion. Once Britain is removed from the equation,
yeah,
once there's no outside interference whatsoever, the Irish people themselves solely can decide what type of government they want, and then rejoin the Commonwealth if they want to have any type of government. But first you have to remove the guns to the head, so to speak, from Britain.
Yeah, and that remains an argument by Republicans throughout the whole period.
Originally, you have those meetings between De Valera. Originally, you have a correspondence between De Valera and Lloyd George. It was quite interesting, even getting to how they're going to describe each other and who is parties to negotiations. Mm. It's just endless letters back and forth. Is Lloyd George negotiating with the representatives of the Irish Republic? Is he dealing with the largest party in Southern Ireland, yeah, elected at the, like, 1921 election?
Yeah.
And this is like before a negotiation can even take part. Yeah. It's like all these questions present themselves.
And this is the case throughout, actually. There's two parallel dialogues going on. That the Irish dialogue is that representatives of the Dáil, the Irish Republic, negotiating with the British government. The British government, the Parliament of Southern Ireland, you know, negotiating a constitutional settlement, you know, with its superiors. Hmm. And that kind of tension is never resolved, really, in the period after the treaty. This goes on, whether there's a government just to implement the treaty or whether it's a sovereign Irish government. But we'll get to that in a second. But yeah, so initially there's these talks between De Valera and Lloyd George. And initially they fingered De Valera as a moderate compared to Collins, who, as they knew, had a very key dominant position in the military wing of the Irish Republican movement. As everybody knows, I think, De Valera was not the man who went to London to negotiate the treaty, something which has always been very controversial. John Regan's book has, I think, very enlightening things to say about this, which is De Valera's position was that he was aware that they couldn't get recognition of the Irish Republic. That wasn't going to happen, unfortunately. But as I alluded to already, De Valera hoped to get either All-Ireland Dominion status or a non-Dominion Southern state. And he said, if we hold out on the high ground, if you like, of the Republic, we can get one or the other.
Hmm.
And he says to the negotiating team, the plenipotentiaries led by Michael Collins and Arthur Griffith and others, you take their final offer, bring it back to Dublin to the cabinet, and I will step in and make a final counter offer. And now this is my interpretation, but for my money, De Valera understands that their foot soldiers, both literally their foot soldiers in the IRA, but also the political activists in Sinn Féin and so forth, are very deeply wedded, emotionally wedded to the idea of a republic. But he understands that's not really attainable in the negotiations. So De Valera's plan is to come out of it with something that you can sell as a victory. That's my interpretation. It didn't quite transpire like that, though.
No, and that becomes one of the big controversies and most well-known tropes about anyone discussing the treaty is that, why didn't De Valera go?
Mm.
And that seems to make sense from my point of view, that you would leave the final arbiter at home, that it gives you a final get-out clause. You have to bring the treaty back to give a final okay.
I mean, it's common enough for people to send envoys in international negotiations and for them to refer back. Like Putin sends Lavrov, for example, to do a lot of his negotiation. But it's understood Putin's going to have the final say. If De Valera and Putin would be a good analogy, I'm not sure. But I mean, there is the other point of view, though, which has always been, and the pro-treatyites will constantly cite, actually, in the years ahead, this has probably been forgotten a little bit now, that De Valera was never a real, they would say, was never a real Republican, because he always had in the back of his mind that there would need to be a compromise.
Mm.
So it was all about De Valera and his ego. It was with the likes of Richard Mulcahy. And pro-treatyites would always argue, and they would always hold a terrible bitterness because they considered that De Valera had led lesser intellects down a path which he didn't even believe in. We'll come back to that whole question of the treaty split. But I mean, from the point of view of the treaty negotiations, Collins, Griffith, Robert Barton, Erskine Childers as the secretary, George Gavin Duffy.
Duggan.
Yeah, Eamon Duggan.
Yeah.
Are sent over with as plenipotentiaries. This means they have the power to sign a treaty. But De Valera doesn't want them to do that, of course. So they go over to London and there's ensue a very intensive rounds of negotiations.
Well, it seems from reading the reports about the plenipotentiaries that went over that there didn't seem to be any unity of purpose, that there seemed to be a lot of splits and divisions within the Irish ranks compared to a united British front.
Mm.
That can only have hurt the Irish cause over there.
I think the cracks sort of developed during the negotiations as they went along. I was going to say famously, it's not that famously, but... Very interestingly, Griffith himself was sort of, you'd almost say, played by Lloyd George to drive a wedge in the Irish ranks.
Well, I think that's the thing that most people aren't aware of. The fact that during the treaty negotiations, there was a big unionist conference coming up in Liverpool. And one of the things that the government feared was that the conference would pass a resolution calling on the government to call off negotiations with Sinn Féin and... Lloyd George, in his discussions with Arthur Griffith, said we need something from you, some sort of assurance that the plenipotentiaries will accept the crown, will accept inclusion within the empire, so that we have something we can say to the conference, something we can say behind the scenes that, look, these negotiations are going to be worthwhile, they're going to be fruitful. And it really does seem like Griffith handed over a lot of his negotiating cards before the treaty had even been
signed. He signed a letter, though, promising Lloyd George that he would kind of concede these things, which is an extraordinary thing for the leader of a delegation to do.
It doesn't seem to have been particularly secret as well, and the cabinet knew he was having these discussions back and forth and giving these assurances to Lloyd George, so it wasn't something he was doing entirely off his own bat. But at the same time, it does... put the Irish delegation very much on the back foot.
Yeah, and at the last minute, of course, this really comes home to roost. But in the meantime, there's also a fallacy, it's been really popular in the last maybe 20 years, 30 years, is that, the treaty had nothing to do with partition. In fact, there was intensive negotiations on the question of partition during the treaty negotiations.
Well, they seem to be the two biggest issues with regard to treaty negotiations. Partition and the role of the Crown and Empire.
Basically, partition and independence, I would put it that way.
That if you couldn't get both, one or the other.
Yeah.
And it was discussed at Cabinet in Dublin, as the plenipotentiaries were going back between London and Dublin, that this would be a reason to break off negotiations at any stage, that they could break them off on either Ulster or the Crown, rather than giving up both.
Mm.
There's always a get-out clause, a reason to... break off negotiations and then go back and see can you get further concessions from the British.
Mm. And it's a dangerous game, actually, because just to step away from London for a second, in Ireland, in late 1921. Nobody is really sure that this is permanent peace or anything like that. I mean, the IRA are intensively recruiting and rearming. There's several shipments coming to County Waterford of modern arms from Germany, Thompson submachine guns from America, you know, and they're distributing these. And for example, I have read about rallies around the Cavan Monaghan area. This is just for example. And, you know, Richard Mulcahy, who's the chief of staff of the IRA, goes up there and he gets asked by the local commanders, which is Sean McKeown, Paul Galligan, and Dan Hogan. He gets asked by them, is the truce going to hold? And Mulcahy says, I really don't know. Mm. You know, it may or may not, you know, depending on the way negotiations go. And he says, but look, get ready. Mm. And interestingly enough, the British Army tell their people exactly the same thing. They say, you know, these negotiations may go one way or the other, and the rebels, as they call them, will be considerably better armed and better organised than they had been previously. He said this will be conflict on a new scale. So both sides are on the ground in Ireland are preparing themselves for the failure of the talks. Like, it's not a foregone conclusion at all.
No, and I was looking at the Earl of Middleton's memoirs there recently, one of the two memoirs, and he talks about, you know, what the British government really had to do to defeat Sinn Féin would have been, and it's extraordinary reading it, shut down all rail links, all rail travel throughout the country, shut down post and postal services for 6 months, and bring in 50,000 troops, extra troops into the country. After 6 months, sweep through the country after declaring martial law. And that seems extraordinary to read something like that.
But I mean, you know, this is the British Empire we're talking about. They didn't get an empire by being nice, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, I assume, standard practice in places like India, you know. So going back to London, though, and the treaty negotiations on the question of partition. Now, just to outline, many people will be aware, but the six-county area, which was excluded way back in 1914 from the Home Rule Bill, which was granted its own parliament in 1920, this area has pretty substantial nationalist majorities around its fringes, really, particularly places like Derry City, Newry, South Down, South Armagh. Fermanagh and Tyrone, counties Fermanagh and Tyrone as a whole, had nationalist majorities. And the nationalist argument was, well, how can you justify the inclusion of these areas in the what was now going to be known as Northern Ireland under the 1920 Act? How can majority nationalist areas be included? And there's a lot of back and forth over how you can decide this. And there's proposals that Fermanagh and Tyrone be taken back into the southern area. There's proposals that instead of the counties being used as administrative areas, you use poor law areas, for example. But it all actually comes to nothing in the end. I mean, really, the British give nothing on partition. Not an inch, really.
Well, you can see the negotiations going on between James Craig and Lloyd George.
We should say separate to the treaty negotiations.
Yeah, they're not party to the negotiations, but they're definitely in the background and very much affected by what's going to happen. And at this stage, you know, there's been an election in the north. There is now a government, and there is now a cabinet led by James Craig as Prime Minister, and still in quite precarious situation.
Extremely precarious. Yeah. I mean, we should say that, I mean, there's a kind of undeclared war really going on between North and South throughout this period, you know. There's low-level violence all along the border and in Belfast throughout the period.
And the one thing you get from reading through the Northern Unionists' standpoint is they achieve an awful lot just through obdurate refusal to
bloody-mindedness.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah.
And it's not a criticism.
No. The game is the game.
Yeah, like, as far as Craig is concerned, like, this is negotiations between the south of Ireland, the 26 counties, and the Westminster government. It's nothing to do with them.
Mm.
The argument being that, well, the six-county area and its government be part of a new All-Ireland, but retain its powers and retain its parliament as some sort of federal solution?
Mm.
Would you have a diminution of the area controlled by the Belfast Parliament? And eventually it ends up with Article 12 of the treaty.
Mm. Which states that under the treaty, Northern Ireland has the right to vote if it wants to join what became the Irish Free State or not. And interestingly enough, I mean, my take on it is that the British really didn't mind, you know, that the British would have been just as happy to see Northern Ireland in a Dominion settlement, because that would have almost cemented the Irish state within a Dominion context anyway, you know, had the Unionists been part of it. But, I mean, the upshot of it is that Northern Ireland decides its own destiny, is to decide its own destiny, that there's no question of an end to partition immediately. Now, most people in the south of Ireland, and quite a few people in the north of Ireland, didn't believe that partition could be a long-term thing, even after that. I mean, okay, the unionists had a majority in Northern Ireland, so Northern Ireland deciding its future meant a unionist thing. But most people in the south assumed that Northern Ireland just wouldn't be viable.
Mm.
That, you know, they were constantly talking in early 1922 that it would be bankrupt, that they would just have to come into the rest of the Irish state, that they couldn't sustain themselves.
Well, that leads to the other part of the article about the Boundary Commission.
Yes. Okay, the boundary, yeah, and going back to the question of, I mean, the very large parts of Northern Ireland. I mean, actually, at the time of partition, I think it's the ratio of Catholics and Protestants, which is a very blunt way of describing it, but the ratio of Catholics and Protestants, so therefore almost all nationalists and unionists, is like 70-30, I think, in the Protestant unionist favour. But Catholics are nationalists, again, for the most part, are concentrated in areas around the fringes of the west of the six-county area, the south and west of the six-county area, and had the same principle of like self-determination of minorities been applied, they would have seceded, if you like, from Northern Ireland and joined the Free State. And the Boundary Commission is supposed to be able to do that. The treaty had the possibility of for Irish reunification or at least repartition, but neither of those things came to pass in the end. But anyway, just to be clear, though, what the negotiators brought back on partition was that there was no immediate change, but that Northern Ireland could come in to the Free State if it wished. And there was a Boundary Commission, which was hopefully going to redraw the border to make Northern Ireland, well, nationalists hoped, to make Northern Ireland like an unviable rump entity.
Well, this is the thing, when you read the text of Article 12, in retrospect, it's very interesting. It's like, in accordance with the wishes of the population, I can't think exactly how it's worded, but it's like, and also taking into account economic factors and stuff like that. When you look at things like, you know, the Silent Water Reservoir in South Down, that supplies water to Belfast.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, that has to remain within the Northern Ireland area, even though South Down is a very an overwhelmingly nationalist area. Same with Derry City. Is it within a majority nationalist area? Is it economically feasible to leave that out of Northern Ireland? Like, the whole argument from the nationalist point of view that Northern Ireland would lose so much territory that it would be unviable going forward, sort of almost contradicted by the terms of Article 12 to begin with.
Okay, so let's come back to that, you know, the future of partition. But the other, like you said, the other big question is the question of the status of the Southern Irish state, which was to become the Irish Free State, whether it would be a republic, which, like I said, the British were probably never going to agree to, or whether it was going to be subject to the Crown. So how did that develop?
Well, it's interesting. They're going to follow the same sort of idea as the other dominions. You would have a Governor General as a representative of the Crown in Ireland. You're going to have a lower house and a Senate, like a House of Commons, for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, actually, I just want to have a little word about that, because going back to the days of the Home Rule Bill, the Senate, there had been an idea for a Senate and that, and the idea was that the Senate would be there to safeguard the right of the Unionist Protestant minority in the south of Ireland, or in all of Ireland, originally was the idea. And it was very much originally intended as a kind of a House of Lords, like the gentry class, what we know as the Anglo-Irish class, was going to be overrepresented in it. It wasn't represented, well, no more than the Senate today, but it wasn't going to be elected by popular vote, it was going to be by appointment. The inclusion of the Senate was very much supposed to be representative of Southern Unionists originally, so that was one thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have these same issues with the Home Rule Bill, that like, any new Irish government can't favour any one religion over another.
Yeah, which
can't discriminate.
Well, I'm with them on that personally. Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, to be fair, this is also a republican principle. I mean, you know, Sinn Féin and the IRB are arguing this way back, you know, in the 19th century and the early 20th century. But as regards the position of the Crown, I mean, this is one of those things where people nowadays, from the later 20th century, say, why on earth would people spend so much time arguing about things like the Oath of Allegiance to the Crown? And my response to that is, okay, that's fine, as long as it applies to both sides. But I mean, if you're to apply that test to it, the British insist that there must be an oath explicitly saying that the members of the Parliament, the people who hold power in the new Irish state, are subject to and loyal to the Crown. This is a breaking point for both sides in the negotiation. So it's not just one side being obdurate or being abstract or, you know, fanatical. It's an important thing for both sides, and it's important to think about why that is. One reason is like optics, as they call it now. Like, it allows the British to save face, like I said. They didn't lose. They negotiated a favourable settlement. But the other thing is that, as a starting point for a state, it is important where sovereignty lies. It is important to say, if the state exists because it's loyal to the Crown of England, that says very important things about the identity of the state. Mm-hmm. If the state exists because of the, as you know, the Republicans would claim, because of the will of the Irish people, that's a whole other trajectory for the Irish state in what it can and can't do. Not only in what it is, but what it actually can and can't do. So a state created by the Irish people, through the will of the people, has the right to declare itself independent, to go its own way in foreign policy, and so forth. And remember, this is right after the First World War. A state that's subject to the Crown, that's created by the Crown and is loyal to the Crown, does not have those prerogatives, not in theory. So, you know, these are not, you know, meaningless things.
No.
They're actually important things.
And it's also as well, this is before the Statute of Westminster, when...
Which changed the game.
Which changed the game, but technically all...
Can you just explain what that was there?
Yeah, like technically all Dominion parliaments are subject to the Mother Parliament, the Imperial Parliament in Westminster. So Westminster has the final say, can override, in a sense, all the governments in Ottawa and South Africa, Australia. So there is definitely a hierarchy in terms of power.
Mm.
But the other thing as well, when we're talking about oaths, and this becomes an issue with the treaty negotiations subsequent to the treaty being signed, is that from the point of view of those opposed to the treaty, they've already taken an oath to contradict that oath, from their point of view, as perjury, an oath to the Irish Republic.
Yeah, and just to back up that, I mean, in 1919, well, first of all, people who were elected to the Dáil, they took an oath to uphold the Irish Republic. But also, the much more numerous numbers of people in the Volunteers and Common the Man also took an oath to uphold and defend the Republic and to recognise no other government in Ireland except the Irish Republic.
Hmm.
You know, and they swore before God to uphold this, and this is, you know, this is a religious society, this is a society that takes oaths very seriously. That's another side of it. That's the emotional side rather than the kind of the theoretical side. But this is a real breaking point in negotiations. It's a really important point. Before we get onto the kind of the crux, the final flurry of negotiations that produced the treaty, we should acknowledge a number of things that the British did concede, things they never would have conceded 5 years earlier. For example, they conceded that the new state was to have an Irish army. The British army was to be evacuated, which is no small thing. And they conceded that the RIC, the Royal Irish Constabulary, was to be disbanded and replaced with an Irish police force. They conceded that the government of Ireland would set its own budget, that it would collect its own taxes without interference from Westminster. And Arthur Griffith would argue, with some justification, that these were the real building blocks of statehood. Whatever about the theory, which we've talked about, the substance of an independent Irish state was there. So there was the treaty, from a nationalist point of view, was by no means all negative. It was actually quite a big advance on Home Rule in some ways.
But is it conceivable that anything less than these points would have even been entertained by a majority section of the Sinn Féin movement or the Volunteer movement?
No, of course not. No, it wouldn't. But still, you know. Yeah.
Probably the most controversial thing about signing of the end of the treaty negotiations is Lloyd George's threat, a threat that unless the treaty was signed immediately, there was warships ready to depart British shores,
right, yeah.
There was thousands of British troops ready to restart the war immediately, and they had to sign right now.
Yeah, he famously produced two letters. Which one will I send? There's a lot of, I don't think there's official documents about this, or if there are, I don't know about them, but there is a lot of conjecture from people who were there, and anecdotes and reports, including from MacReady, the Commander-in-Chief, and he wrote in his memoirs that there was absolutely no way that they were in a, you know, in a position to wage war immediately.
Yeah.
You know, that they, okay, they still had a lot of forces in the country. The auxiliaries and Black and Tans and so forth had not been disbanded. They were in their depots and barracks and stuff like that. But they certainly weren't ready for immediate and terrible war. They weren't on a war footing. Lloyd George tries to bring negotiations to a head on the contentious issues, basically, on partition, which we've talked about, on the oath, the insistence that the members of the new Irish Parliament would have to swear an oath of fidelity. Well, first of all, to the Constitution of Ireland, I mean, they got talked down to that, and then fidelity to the monarch, the King of England. And he threatens the Irish negotiation team, and he says, you know, you have to choose war or peace. I don't want to hear any in-betweens anymore. And one of the problems with the negotiating team is Griffith has already made promises to Griffith that he would sign on those terms, you know, on a Dominion terms with certain other things.
which kind of undermines the position of the rest of the team. Now, a number of the members of the negotiating team had pretty grave reservations about the treaty as it was, notably Robert Barton and Erskine Childers. Well, Erskine Childers was the secretary rather than a plenipotentiary, but those two, and I think a number of others.
As far as I know, they sort of signed in drips and drabs, and they had to be with Griffith first and then moving on. And then there was also the belief amongst sections of the plenipotentiaries that the British were sort of doing the divide and conquer thing, where we're negotiating separately on separate issues and, you know, discussing things like defence, you know, in different modules of the negotiations.
And funny enough, I mean, Collins was quite scathing of some of his colleagues. He thought they were pretty amateurish, and especially Childers. You know, he said his mind wandered and he talked about irrelevant things. The performance of the Irish team seems to have been mixed, let's say. I mean, they weren't experienced enough. And some of the ones who had more experience in, like, imperial affairs, like Childers, seemed to have been the greatest liabilities. Eventually, I think, as in many things in the period, it's Collins' force of personality that brings the rest of them round. And Collins becomes convinced that this is the only thing to do at this point, is to sign the treaty. And he gets them all to sign. Now, the thing about this is, let's go back to where we were a few minutes ago. De Valera, who is the president of the Republic, he's the president of the Dáil, as the system existed at the time, had said that they're not to sign any agreement until they bring it back to the cabinet in Dublin. And they had actually been back in Dublin a few days previously before the signature, and there was a very stormy discussion about these things. And
but that point had been agreed on by all.
But the point had still been agreed that they were to bring the thing back. Now, but they were, you know, this is late at night, there's all night negotiations, and they sign. And then they go back to Dublin. And this is the beginning, really, of what we know as the Civil War Division. There had been kind of antecedents, but it really starts here. De Valera says to them, apparently, in a cabinet meeting, according to Peace by Ordeal, which is a good book on the treaty negotiations, "I told you to bring back either all Ireland, a united Ireland, or an independent southern state, not affiliated with the Crown. And you brought back neither this nor that." And Cathal Brua, who was actually a long-time personal enemy, really, of Michael Collins, but who's also pretty staunch Republican or separatist, is also dead against it. There's a furious break within the cabinet over this point.
Over whether it would even be allowed to be presented to the Dáil in the first instance.
Yep.
The cabinet at the time, well, the inner cabinet, it's seven people. Mm. So you have De Valera, Griffith, Collins, Brua, Stack, Cosgrave, and Barton.
Mm.
So that, out of those seven. And there was an expectation even that Cosgrave would vote along with De Valera, Stack, and Brua. I think there was a bit of surprise that Cosgrave voted with the others to allow the Dáil to make the final decision. And Barton actually votes to allow, even though he ends up voting against the treaty, allowing the Dáil to have the final decision on whether to accept it or not.
Yeah, I mean, and it shows actually, for me, a negotiating team should have their strategy mapped out well in advance. You know, you shouldn't be negotiating, you know, when you're in the negotiating room.
Mm.
And you shouldn't be deciding things like, if you're going to do something as important as sign an international treaty, which is what this amounts to, you shouldn't be doing like, for example, Barton does, sign the treaty and then go back on it, then side against it. I mean, that should be unthinkable. You should have all worked this out beforehand. So it does show the amateurishness of the Irish team and the Irish government, really, I think.
Well, you notice in recent discussions, and even if we look at like the Good Friday Agreement, there's a definite end. There's like, on this date, that's when we have to have something agreed. We have a time frame, and this is the final point.
Mm.
Whereas with the treaty, it seems to be quite arbitrary. It seems to be Lloyd George decides, right,
enough's enough.
Enough's enough, here we go.
Yeah.
Sign or don't sign.
Yeah, we've got wars elsewhere to go to. Mm. But I can't help but thinking, I mean, you know, of course you should never compare what happened long after with what happened before. But like, let's look at the Good Friday Agreement for a second. And let's look at the Sinn Féin of those years, Provisional Sinn Féin or whatever you want to call them. Can you imagine a situation where they sent a delegation to those negotiations who didn't agree with each other, who publicly fell out with each other and gave different commitments? No, it would not have happened.
No.
Because they were so much better prepared than the treaty negotiation team were.
Yeah.
The treaty delegation, I should say, were. One thing I find interesting, though, is reading the reactions of political and military activists in Ireland when they heard of the treaty, because it was published the next day. In hindsight, because of the split over the treaty and the way it went, the reactions on the ground on hearing the treaty were pretty much entirely negative.
people like, for example, Owen O'Duffy, who was later a pro-treaty stalwart, who was a general in the pro-treaty army, the National Army, who was the first commissioner of the Gardaí, were apparently, according to eyewitnesses on the ground, had a furious reaction against the treaty. He was in Richard Mulcahy's house in Dublin, and he said, "Dick, the army will never stand for this." The army, meaning the IRA, will never stand for this. That seems to be the reaction across the board. I mean, I've been reading a lot of these, mostly anti-treaty, I should say, to be fair, because they tended to leave far more memoirs of the period for some reason. Maura Comerford, for example, the Come of the Man activist, says she was in a house in Bushy Park. Bushy Park Road in Terenure. She burst out crying when she heard the treaty for terms. She went home and she went to bed because she said it was a terrible surrender of Republican principles, that all these people had gone out and died for nothing. You know, that's the way she saw it. Todd Andrews, who's a young IRA man in Dublin, hears about the treaty negotiations, and his words are, you know, when he heard the fact that they'd have to pay for the pensions of the RAC, who were going to be disbanded, but they'd still pay their pensions, that the British would keep three ports around the coast of Ireland, keep naval bases there, military bases really, you know, and of course the Oath of Allegiance, as Republicans always called it, to the British monarch. He said he couldn't believe that Mick Collins, somebody he admired and respected, had agreed to it. So there's a lot of this goes on, but one of the prophetic things though is that Collins comes back to Dublin and he meets his most trusted men, or some of his most trusted men in the squad in the intelligence department. These are, if you like, they're almost his personal force. They're like a Roman Emperor's Praetorian Guard in the IRA. And he meets Tom Cullen, who's one of the senior people among this group. And he says, apparently, now this is according to Cullen's recollections, he says to Cullen, "What will the boys think of this?" The boys meaning his own men in the intelligence branch of the IRA. And he says, "If it's good enough for you, it's good enough for them." This is, from a pro-treaty point of view, this is a really key thing among, you know, the hardcore pro-treaty Republicans. What's good enough for Mick is good enough for me. So it's the force in particular of Collins' personality that drives the acceptance of the treaty within the movement. Now, the reaction in wider society seems to have been a lot more favourable. It's difficult to judge this, of course, but, I mean, from the very start, the pro-treaty line is, whatever the Republican movement says, the treaty is the will of the people. And this is being turned out from early December 1921. So this is being turned out way before there's elections or Dáil votes. I looked at the treaty debates in rural areas along the border in Cavan, Monaghan, Louth, Longford, Leitrim. One thing that's interesting about it is it shows the kind of level of local democracy, informal democracy that existed in Ireland at the time, by which I mean, as well as county councils and formal elected bodies, there was farmers' union meetings, trade union meetings, Sinn Féin club meetings, things like this in all these areas. I mean, these things were those public meetings where people argued back and forth about these things. Now, what's really interesting I found was that the pro-treaty people, I mean, and these were Sinn Féin people, you know, IRA people, and also not, I mean, were farmers' party people, former unionists, but majority of the people who attended such meetings were Sinn Féin supporters. And the pro-treaty line was that the treaty is the will of the people, 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 repeated like a mantra. You know, this is clearly the pro-treaty line from a very early stage. Just to go back a bit, the Republican reaction, the reaction in the Republican movement, and in particular in the IRA and in Cumann na mBan, the women's really quasi-military organisation, is extremely disappointed. They felt really let down by the treaty.
Well, does this make you think that the Republican movement as a whole hadn't really been prepared for possible outcomes?
Absolutely. And this is the key political failure for me. Now, this is, I repeat something I said earlier, this is my interpretation. But my interpretation is that De Valera understands that compromise must be sold in a way that makes it look like a victory. And Collins, who is in some ways a very shrewd political operator, doesn't appear to understand this as well. He seems to have thought that, you know, breaking personal alliances with people, which is how he worked, isn't enough to get it over the line. But in the end, that didn't prove enough. He wasn't skillful enough, I think, in manoeuvring or managing the, not only managing the message, but being able to prepare people and move people together in a way that they believed in at the same time, which De Valera, it turned out, later in his career, really, De Valera turned out to be very good at this. And Collins, for my money, this was his big failing, that he failed to do this within his own movement in terms of the treaty.
Well, one of the points that's always brought up is that if De Valera would have supported the treaty, those that had become anti-treatyites or those that fought against the treaty would have fallen into line behind them and supported the treaty. Is that your reading of the case?
No, short version. Okay, yes and no. There's two parallel splits, right? There's the political split and the military split, the split in the IRA. Now, let's take the political one first. So the Dáil meets, there's very contentious, bad-tempered debate on the treaty, and De Valera's party, it's not led formal party, but De Valera's adherents vote against the treaty. They argue things like that it betrays the dead. They argue that it doesn't have, as De Valera himself argued, it didn't achieve either one of the movement's key aims, which is the unity of Ireland or independence of Ireland, and so on and so forth. The pro-treatyites argue that it's the best that could be achieved. Look at all that it got. It got the, you know, the pillars of statehood. There's possibility of united Ireland under the treaty. One thing we may come back to is that a common trope recently is that the treaty debates ignored partition, but actually partition, I would argue, is at the centre of events in the 6 months after the treaty, but we'll come back to that. After the Dáil vote, the Dáil voted for the treaty narrowly. Then they narrowly voted not to re-elect De Valera as president. It appears that De Valera's strategy then and later was that the Dáil would ultimately reject the treaty or reject the constitution based on the treaty, and they'd be able to renegotiate it. That appears to have been De Valera's strategy. Now, that's the political split. IRA commanders wrote to Richard Mulcahy, who was their chief of staff, who was publicly endorsed the treaty, as early as February 1922, or shortly after the Dáil approved the treaty, saying they wanted a convention of the IRA to discuss the treaty. Now, remember that the IRA is not a normal army. It's a voluntary organisation. Its original name is the Volunteers. They elected their own officers. It's supposed to be a democracy, like a citizen's army, if you like. They hold this convention in March 26, 1922. They do something that turns out to be very significant. They repudiate the authority of the Dáil over the army, because the way they justify this is that the IRA, the Republican Army, was set up to uphold the Irish Republic. The Dáil was set up to uphold the Irish Republic. If the Dáil repudiates the Irish Republic, it no longer has authority over the army. And this is the purest Republican position that's going to cause a lot of bloodshed over the following 2 years. But it isn't that Eamon de Valera said to the IRA in the Mansion House in March 1922, I don't agree with the treaty, and neither should you. You should follow my lead and bring down the pro-treaty settlement. That's not what happened at all. The IRA have gone a step much further than De Valera ever wanted to go. De Valera wanted to work inside the Dáil to renegotiate the treaty, or if not to renegotiate the treaty, renegotiate the constitution of the Free State, as it would then be. So there are two parallel things going on. They're not the same thing. Now, there is an argument the pro-treatyites would make, and their kind of intellectual descendants would make over the decades, which is that the IRA, anti-treaty IRA, would never have had the confidence to oppose the treaty, to oppose the decision of the Dáil, had it not been for De Valera. Had it not been for De Valera subsequently touring places held by anti-treaty IRA units and saying things like, the treaty blocks the way to Irish freedom, and if the Volunteers will strike out again for a republic, they may have to wade through the rivers of blood, including some members of this government, which he did say. It didn't help matters. But it's certainly not the case that the IRA is following De Valera. For me, it's the other way around. De Valera is trying to co-opt and bring back the IRA in pursuit of his political agenda. Now, he gets it very wrong, because it turns out he can't control these people at all. He doesn't get control back over these people until after the IRA ceasefire of 1923, after the Civil War. So he gets it very wrong. But for me, the story is certainly not the IRA following De Valera. It's De Valera following the IRA, which is a different thing.
And that's the thing, I think we get an idea into De Valera's political thinking during the treaty debate, that he presents his original plan, which is becomes known as document number two. And it's funny, if we look at document number two, that it becomes, at a much later stage, the blueprint for Fianna Fáil's dismantling of the treaty after the 1932 election.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things is that in De Valera's papers, he does keep going back to this idea that you remove the crown from the south of Ireland and or, but his idea is actually you keep some sort of vestigial relationship with Britain to satisfy the unionists who are going to come in at some point. In some ways, De Valera's thinking is actually kind of consistent. His method of getting there changes. One thing as well that's interesting, though, on De Valera is that the Dáil approves the treaty, but then there's the first general election in June. We're skipping a lot of stuff that happened, but the IRA, obviously there's a big split in the IRA, but there's an election in June 22, and the pro-treaty side, the pro-treaty faction of Sinn Féin, is the majority party in the, or would have been the majority party in the new Dáil, the first parliament of the Irish Free State. Even after that election, which De Valera decries, he says the imperialists, the British, have manipulated the Irish people. But even after that election, De Valera publicly says, he's going to go into the Dáil, and he hopes members of the Dáil won't endorse the constitution, which includes the oath of allegiance to the king. So it's clear, even after that election, that De Valera's plan is not to use the IRA to bring down the government. De Valera never says anything like that before the outbreak of civil war. De Valera's plan is to get the Dáil to reject the treaty by some means. And De Valera constantly bemoans the fact that the IRA have done this thing of publicly repudiating the Dáil, which is very hard to kind of come back from in political terms.
I think as well, if we look at like a lot of people's idea of the treaty and stuff like that is influenced by the Michael Collins film.
Just to stop you here for one second, I mean, Michael Collins film, also kind of popular representations like Tim Pak Ugin's biography of Michael Collins, yes, for example. I mean, it's not just a Michael Collins film. There's a kind of a pop culture thing that's assembled in a number of different kind of media.
The way the treaty vote is portrayed is that, like, in the wake of the vote on the treaty, the anti-treatyites leave the Dáil and that's the end of it.
No, they leave the Dáil and go back.
In the wake of De Valera resigning the presidency once the treaty vote is lost, Arthur Griffith then becomes president of the Irish Republic and accepts the presidency of the Irish Republic. And the Dáil continues on with the anti-treatyites holding their seats until the next election then in June 1922. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem, I think, from a purist Republican viewpoint is that the Second Dáil was never formally dissolved properly before the Third Dáil comes into effect.
Yeah, you know, we're going to confuse the listeners with this, but we have to go into it. So under the treaty, one of the things we talked about earlier was that, you know, there was no consensus between the Irish and British sides over what was actually happening. So again, from the Irish point of view, this is a negotiation between two sovereign states. The British point of view, it's the British negotiating with the local parliament that they've created. And in the same way, the treaty is interpreted, or the implementation of the treaty is, for the British, they have a provisional government in charge for a year to oversee the implementation of the treaty. And until that, what's meeting is the Parliament of Southern Ireland, which is a British-created institution. And that's what's happening in the south of Ireland from the British point of view. From the Irish point of view, the Dáil and the Republic still exists, but the Dáil and the Republic have voted to endorse a new settlement, which is the Irish Free State, which is going to come into being December 7th, 1922, so a year and a day after the signing of the treaty. And nobody ever really clears this up. So there's two parallel structures. There's the provisional government, which is set up under the treaty. There's the Dáil and the Irish Republic, which is still in existence. And nobody ever really clarifies this. You know, it takes the Civil War to clarify this, actually. Arthur Griffith is the president of the Irish Republic. He's the president of the Dáil. But Michael Collins is the head of the provisional government, right? Who's really in charge? Now, actually, the truth is it's Collins. But really, that's more to do with Collins' unofficial power over the army.
Commander-in-chief of the National Army.
That's what I mean, Commander-in-Chief of the National Army. Although technically he's not that either, until the outbreak of Civil War. But in reality, he is a similar kind of vague position he had in the IRA itself.
And if we wanted to dig even deeper, is Collins' power coming from being Commander-in-Chief of the Army, being Chairman of the Provisional Government, or is Collins President of the Irish Republic because he's head of the IRB?
Now, this is one of the murkiest things about this whole period. So the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, is one of the driving forces behind the Nationalist Revolution, actually from 1857, in terms of this period, from 1916, the insurrection which the members of the Supreme Council launched. Collins and his close allies like Richard Mulcahy, Sean O'Muirhealy, Dermot O'Hagerty used the IRB in the War of Independence period as kind of a directorate to get people they wanted in important positions. What's very interesting is that the IRB is used, now the IRB, it should be said, has pro and anti-treaty members. To be fair, I mean, the likes of Liam Lynch, who goes on to lead the anti-treaty IRA, is a member of the Supreme Council, for example. But the fact is that the majority of the Supreme Council of the IRB, which is a secret organisation, endorses the treaty, probably on Collins' word, really, helps to get the treaty passed in the Dáil, you know, by advice and by orders to its members, helps to get the nucleus of the pro-treaty army formed. The anti-treaty argument is that there's a parallel thing going on here, that there's kind of a power grab by a secret society. Because a lot of Republicans and separatists had felt after 1916, especially after 1919 and the open declaration of an Irish Republic, that there was no such place for a secret clandestine organisation like the IRB. I mean, it's possible that the influence of the IRB has been exaggerated by anti-treatyites, but there's no doubt that it does have an important part behind the scenes in getting the treaty elected and in the exercise of power in the chaotic first 6 months of 1922.
It plays a very interesting role within the National Army, and particularly at the superior officer level, the general level.
Absolutely. You know, if you look at the command of the National Army, certainly from the creation of the National Army under the treaty, which is the very end of January 1922, until the outbreak of civil war in the end of June 1922, and for a long time afterwards, the High Command of the National Army is very strongly composed of IRB people.
I think that could be an entire other podcast on its own about the IRB, but as you said there, I just can't see the rationale behind the IRB continuing to exist past January 1919. Every stripe of republicanism, from the most purists, treats the First Dáil and the vote in 1918 as the Irish Republic, the Dáil being the representatives of the Irish Republic, as the Parliament of the Irish Republic, and in that case, the government led by De Valera. But you have an entire secret organisation there whose entire constitution is that the head of the IRB is the head of the Irish Republic.
Yeah, virtually established. Yeah. The original wording, yeah. It's a strange one, right? I mean, my sense of it is that Collins is not a man who really cares a lot about theory throughout his whole career. I mean, he's also a pretty young guy. I mean, he's always a thrusting young man, you might say, where he doesn't really care about legal niceties. For me, the IRB is an organisation used by Collins to get things done that he wants to get done.
Mm.
And I mean, you know, Collins is a militarist Republican. He's no different really ideologically from the people on the other side. It's just that Collins has made this decision to accept the treaty terms. He's committed to this position and he wants to get it done. And the IRB is a way to get it done. You know, I don't really think that Collins particularly cared about, you know, legal stuff. The other thing is about Collins is that Collins had a tendency throughout the whole period where he becomes an important character to assemble informal power around himself. So power that has no legal title under anybody's institutional positions, whether it be in the IRA, where technically he's only the director of intelligence, but really he's running the organisation, whether it be in the provisional government, where he has one position under the treaty and no position under the Dáil, and so forth, whether it be in the National Army, which he's not the commander of until the outbreak of civil war, but he's really the commander of. This is just Collins' way of getting things done.
Do you think that the treaty ultimately had to lead to civil war?
I think that part of the British strategy is that they needed to split the Republican movement in Ireland to get a settlement that was acceptable to them. We've already talked about the British had certain strategic and credibility needs that they needed to fulfil in a settlement in Ireland. They were aware that they needed to really to split the Republican movement. Interestingly enough, they thought originally De Valera was the man who could have delivered on it, because Michael Collins they thought was an extremist.
Mm.
It turned out to be the other way around, you know, via Arthur Griffith. Now, having said that, I think had it been left to the Irish alone, I think there was a possibility, good possibility, of a compromise if features of the settlement, such as the oath, had managed to be omitted. Now, certain people would never have been happy, but for example, Liam Lynch, who was in many ways the driving force behind the anti-treaty IRA, as opposed to the political movement, would certainly have accepted this constitution that was proposed in May 1922, which would have had no mention of the British monarch. And there were other things where, you know, the army would have been reunited and there would have been an equal number of pro and anti-treaty people elected onto its command and so forth. I think that under those terms, yeah, a split was avoidable or reducible, let's say. There probably would have been some sort of split anyway. There probably would have even have been some bloodshed, I think. We didn't talk about the occupation of the forecourts, but let's just say it suffices for our purposes tonight to say that an extremist group, if you like, under Rory O'Connor and Liam Mellows and Ernie O'Malley really occupied the forecourts in Dublin and basically would brook no compromise and had as an aim restarting war with the British. Now, probably some confrontation with them may have been inevitable, although even Rory O'Connor was prepared, it seems, to accept Lynch's compromise had it been available. And O'Malley talks in his memoirs about he was thinking about going back to medical school. So even with the most extreme elements of the IRA, there probably was some sort of compromise possible. What vetoed it was the British, which sounds like a partisan point to make, but I mean, it's something that's been clearly documented. The British, and in particular Winston Churchill, said, if there is a republic declared in Ireland, we will militarily reoccupy the country. And he didn't say this in secret. He said it in Parliament in Westminster. And that scuppered the largest attempt at negotiation. The second thing is, I mean, there was a way, now by the middle of 1922, there was a really serious split in the Republican movement already. And the biggest manifestation of this was there was two rival armies, the National Army, the pro-treaty army, and the anti-treaty IRA, majority of the original IRA. And they were, you know, they were vying for occupation of barracks. They were vying for levying what basically kind of taxes off the population. There were very serious problems there. But what set off the civil war again, the actual civil war, was, again, a British ultimatum. So there's the assassination of Henry Wilson, the retired British general. The British cabinet assume it was the anti-treaty IRA. Turns out nobody's really sure why two London IRA members killed him. But ultimately, it's the Irish Civil War breaks out because the British gave an ultimatum to the pro-treaty government that they had to move against the anti-treaty IRA or else face reoccupation by British forces. So the treaty made a split in the Republican movement certain. It was the British insistence that all aspects of the treaty be adhered to, and that there couldn't be any compromise on aspects and symbolic aspects of the treaty, such as the oath, that made it a certainty, I would say.
Well, that's the thing, when you look at tonight the authorities and when you see the treaty being dismantled by legislation and constitutionally, and as you said there about Churchill, it's interesting reading Churchill speaking in the House of Commons in the 1930s about the treaty.
Mm.
He's absolutely furious, and that the treaty is the treaty is the treaty. You can't abrogate it, you can't change it, or you can't change it unilaterally, just on the Irish side. But the interesting point is, and you know, people tend to take sides, one side or the other, anti-treaty, pro-treaty, and debate it, which is very easy from almost a century afterwards. We tend not to look at the British point of view when all these things are the British culpability. When all these things happened in the 1930s, removing the Governor General, removing the oath, removing the rights to the Privy Council, to appeal to the Privy Council, all the different things that happened, and the
External Association. And return of the treaty
ports. And return of the treaty ports. Now, the return of the treaty ports were, you know, a negotiated thing between the two governments.
That was the bilateral thing.
Yeah, but all the other things to do with the Constitution, they were all done without a shot being fired. Now, you had the trade war and stuff like that. And
A trade war over civil war.
Is it really British intransigence that plays a far bigger part in the civil war than either the pro or anti-treaty side's reaction to it?
And that's a fair point. I mean, look, though, let's be fair. Let's represent all the points of view here. So that's the anti-treaty point of view, right? Which is that a lot of the treaty was unacceptable. It didn't give full independence to Ireland. And this is something that's important to remember. The treaty, though, a big advance on home rule, is not the same as what we have now. So what we have now was also constructed in the 1930s, where the supremacy of the British Parliament and the association with the British Crown were eliminated. Now, that's the anti-treaty point of view, that these things were eliminated later on and the Southern state was put on a better keel. The pro-treaty point of view is that if this was all possible from within the realms and within the confines of constitutional politics, then why did we need a civil war in the first place? Mm. Why not, as Collins said in early 22, treat the treaty as a stepping stone, you know, freedom to achieve freedom. So the pro-treaty point of view is that, and that has some validity as well. There really wasn't a need for a violent break. But let's include a third point of view, that the actual break, as I said, the reason that large-scale warfare broke out between the two factions, the immediate cause of it was the British ultimatum, that this had to happen to the pro-treaty government, the provisional government. So let's consider all these things. Now, before we wrap up our discussion, I mean, the one thing I want to say about the popular understanding of the treaty and the split over the treaty in the Civil War is, you know, there's kind of a vulgar popular understanding that there was a Civil War over partition, and that's not true. But there's another thing.
Or that the treaty created partition.
Or that the treaty created
partition. It's probably the biggest.
Which would be nice and neat, but it's not, it's not true. It's much more messy and complicated. That's not true. But there's a counter myth, if you like, or a trope, that, oh, nobody in the south of Ireland cared about partition, and the Civil War and the treaty was irrelevant to partition, and nobody cared because, you know, there were Southern nationalists. This is nonsense, right? Because, you know, that might be true in the 1970s, for example, when people had, like, intellectually and emotionally disconnected from the North. That was not true in the 1920s. People were constantly talking about partition. Pro-treatyites and anti-treatyites vied with each other to be more anti-partition, right, throughout the treaty debates. The fact that the treaty was so vague on partition, that nobody was entirely sure what was going to happen, meant that it wasn't the key issue in the treaty debates, because nobody accepted in the south of Ireland that partition was a permanent thing. Now, we could have a whole other hour talking about partition, so we won't. But the fact that the key breaks in the treaty issue and what turned into the Civil War were not over partition doesn't mean partition is not important. This is a massive misconception. And partition played a part in all these events in lots of different ways. For example, I mean, at the opening of the Dáil the Third Dáil after the outbreak of the Civil War, the one anti-treaty member who makes it in, Lawrence Skinnell, brings up the issue of partition and is immediately thrown out because, you know, it's too contentious a topic. And there's plenty more examples which we don't have time to go into. Let's just say, for the purposes of this talk, that partition really is important, that people really were committed to ending it at that time. But it was more the force of events that created what we call Southern nationalism or you know, identification with the Southern state. It's kind of a complicated point to make, but let's just say the partition is important to this whole time.
Well, that's certainly food for thought there for the listeners. And we'd love to get your feedback on these shows with the new website we have up, irishhistoryshow.ie. All the previous episodes are up there. You can write comments. You can also contact us on Twitter. That's Irish History Pod, at Irish History Pod. And also on Facebook, that's the Irish History Show. So you can listen to us on Near FM, check out the podcast online. And on behalf of John Dorney and myself, Carl Brennan, thanks very much and keep listening.